Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 152, A Flower Traveled in My Blood, an interview with Haley Cohen Gilliland. Today we have one of our special interview episodes, and the subject we are looking at is a fascinating one. Haley's a journalist, the director of Yale Journalism Initiative, in fact, who has spent time living in Buenos Aires and working as The Economist's Argentina and Uruguay correspondent. Alongside her day job, she started researching the story of the people who were disappeared by Argentina's military government and the grandmothers' movement, which formed to try to find answers about what happened to them. As this is such recent history, Haley was able to take a journalistic approach to this, interviewing the protagonists of the story firsthand. The result is a book which traces events across several generations, from the era before the military junta, right up to the work which continues to this day. I found it a fascinating read, and I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing what Haley has to say. So, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Max.
So, would you be able to start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your connection to the story in the book and why you chose this story?
Yeah, so I moved to Argentina in 2011, shortly after graduating university. And I moved down with a basic working knowledge of what had happened during the dictatorship. I knew that tens of thousands of Argentines had been disappeared by the military regime during that time. But it really wasn't until living in Argentina that I came to understand the full extent of the brutality that had taken place. And the episode that I found the most shocking was that the military had, in this giant purge that the military had perpetrated, they kidnapped approximately 500 babies. And how they did that, they would tend to abduct women who were pregnant, bring them to clandestine detention centers where they were held until they gave birth. Sometimes they were tortured during that time. And then once they gave birth, they were almost immediately separated from their babies, and those new mothers were quietly killed. And their babies, meanwhile, were often placed with military and police families to raise under false identities as though they were their own biological children. And I became really obsessed with the Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo, this incredibly brave group of grandmothers that banded together during that time at immense risk to themselves to find those stolen babies who were their stolen grandchildren. And at the time that I was living in Argentina, it didn't occur to me to start working on this book, which was a fact that I often kicked myself for later on. I was really young and I didn't have much experience yet. So in some ways, I think I'm thankful that, you know, the timing worked out as it did when I had more experience to try to do justice to this incredible story. But essentially, you know, years passed, I was still kind of had not let go of the story. It was something that had always stayed with me. And I moved back to the United States and started talking to friends about it and realized that outside of Argentina, not that many people know about the grandmothers. Not that many people know about what happened during Argentina's dictatorship in general. And that was when I really started to focus on writing this book and telling this story.
So the book in particular, the first half tells the story of the Reusenblit family. And through their personal story, it tells the wider story of Argentina's 20th century. There's obviously loads of events to cover, but to provide a bit of the context, can you introduce some of the main currents which the family lived through?
Yes. So Rosa Reusenblit, who's the main subject of the book, she was a very central member of the Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo until she passed away just a few weeks ago at the age of 106, which honestly, her longevity is very reflective of her character. She just had an iron will. She was so determined and fierce. And she was born in 1919. So she lived through six military coups between when she was born and 1976, when the dictatorship swept into power. You know, Argentina's most brutal dictatorship took hold and began disappearing people. And so I felt very committed to the idea of telling this story through one family, because I think many of the events described in the book, as I just mentioned, you know, a military government stealing babies and killing the mothers of newborns, it's so hard to process that those things happened and that they happened as recently as they did, that it felt like if I could ground those events and the wider history of Argentina through the experience of one family, that it would make it more accessible to readers who didn't personally live through these events. So yeah, that was why I made that decision structurally.
And so a vital part of the story is the search for the disappeared and for their children who ended up in all sorts of places. So can you talk a bit about what happened to the children and about the process of tracking them down?
Yeah, and I guess just to provide more context that maybe I should have provided in the previous question. So there were six military coups between 1930 and 1976 in Argentina. And as you can imagine, that constant swinging between military government and civilian government really hollowed out democratic institutions, sowed great social polarization, and created economic chaos. And by 1975, the year before the most brutal coup took place, Argentina had really descended into chaos. Political violence was rampant. There were right-wing death squads that were sweeping people off the street, and these death squads were actually tacitly supported by the democratic government that was in power then. There were left-wing revolutionary groups that had sprung up to kind of resist what they saw as autocratic creep. And these two sides were clashing really furiously to the point where there was a bomb going off every 3 hours, a political killing was happening every five. And this really provided the context for the military to sweep to power once again in 1976 under the guise of restoring order. But in this particular case, they had a much broader and more sinister plan. You know, the previous dictatorships in Argentina had been repressive. There had been bloodshed in certain coup attempts. But for the most part, the repression was intellectual. It was cultural. There was not a great amount of physical violence during those previous dictatorships. In this case, the military deemed that it was necessary to try to purge the country of anyone whose views it deemed contrary to Western and Christian civilization, and I put that in quotes, and basically anyone whose views they deemed subversive, they decided needed to be disappeared. And so that included certainly leftist revolutionary groups, but also journalists, artists, poets, priests who ministered to the poor, essentially anyone left-leaning. And as part of that purge, hundreds of pregnant women were swept up and sent to these clandestine detention centers where they gave birth, and their babies were stolen and often placed with military and police families. And so in 1977, the Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo formed, and this was when the dictatorship was really at the height of its power. 1976 and 1977 were the bloodiest years of the dictatorship. People were disappearing in droves. So at immense risk to themselves, the grandmothers banded together. And the way that they found each other was that a group of mothers had begun to stage a march in front of the presidential palace, the Casa Rosada, in this iconic square called the Plaza de Mayo, to demand answers about what had happened to their disappeared loved ones, because they weren't getting any information from the other places that they had sought it from. So government buildings and jails and police stations. So they decided to go straight to the most iconic square in Buenos Aires to draw attention to their plight and try to pressure the military government into divulging what it had done with their children. And over time, the grandmothers in this group of mothers who were doing this weekly protest found each other. They realized that in addition to missing their children, they were missing grandchildren, either because those grandchildren had been swept up in raids or because their children had been pregnant at the time of their abductions. And so they were, you know, they were missing unborn grandchildren. They didn't know if they'd been born even. So this group of grandmothers found each other. And at first, what their work looked like was a lot of gumshoe detective work. They would go to government registries and sift through every single birth certificate in the registry to look for hallmarks of fake certificates, red flags, things like documents that were signed by a military or police doctor and that indicated a home birth, which were very, very rare in Argentina at the time. Also, as they continued with their marches, onlookers began to learn what they were doing and would give them anonymous tips. So they might run up to them during a march and whisper something to them or pass them a note that had an address or name that they felt might be relevant to their search. And so this was how things kind of started for the grandmothers.
It's fascinating, very brave. What was the reaction of the junta when they first started doing it?
Yes, it was extremely brave. And very shortly after the grandmothers formed officially, which was in November of 1977, they were confronted with the reality of just how risky what they were doing was, because in December of that year, so just a couple weeks after the grandmothers officially formed, the junta actually disappeared three members of the mothers' movement, you know, three kind of the perceived leaders of this movement, were grabbed from a church and from off the street in broad daylight. And the junta believed that by disappearing these three leaders of the mothers' movement, that they could decapitate the entire movement and that surely these women were not going to continue protesting. But they really misunderestimated the courage and determination of these women, because the very next week, right after these three disappearances had taken place, the mothers and grandmothers were back in the Plaza de Mayo. And they were crying and they were, you know, hugging each other, but they were there to protest once again. And they didn't stop after that either. And after that, I think the junta made the calculation that it couldn't continue trying to disappear members of these movements because there was more attention on them. So they had succeeded in kind of drawing attention to their plight, and therefore by making themselves really visible, they became harder to disappear, because by late 1977, the Argentine junta's international image was already abysmal, and disappearing mothers and grandmothers, elderly women, was not going to help their image. And I think they realized that.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5.
I know where I'm going to bet from now on.
Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
I haven't looked into it in too much detail, but one of the things I found quite interesting was, like, so when the junta finished, when Argentina returned to democracy, there was no kind of big event. There wasn't like a big popular uprising. It just sort of happened. It's kind of a slightly tangential to your book, but I was just wondering if you had any insight into kind of how that, why they kind of, after going, being willing to disappear so many people, throwing them out of helicopters into the sea and things, why they kind of just gave up fairly easily in the end.
Yeah, it's a great question. And as you mentioned, there wasn't any one event that forced them to cede power to a democratic government, but over time, especially in the early 1980s, there was a confluence of things that really eroded their popular support, both in Argentina and internationally. And the combination of those things were economic collapse. A bunch of banks in Argentina went bankrupt at that time. And one of the junta's promises when it took power in 1976 was to not only restore order in terms of quashing political violence, but to restore economic order. And by the early 1980s, it was very clear that the junta had failed on that promise. The more relevant and powerful factors in seeding the road or kind of seeding the path to the military government's demise were, one, people became more aware of what the military was doing. You know, when the military first took power, the institutions that normally hold power to account were completely silent or even in complicit in some cases. So the Argentine Catholic Church was very tightly intertwined with the military. And in most cases, the elite of the Catholic Church supported the military's mission. And so they did not speak out. The press was silent, either because of fear, because the military was disappearing journalists at a very fast clip, or once again, out of complicity. There were certain outlets that were more conservative leaning and in fact, probably, you know, supported what the military was doing. And there was active press censorship as well coming from the military. And so it actually was years before Argentines came to understand the extent of what was happening all around them. You know, the military was really brazen in some ways. They would grab people off the street in broad daylight. But even the relatives of some of the subjects that are centered in my book. So for instance, the cousin of Jose, who's Rosa Reusenblit's son-in-law. I spoke with her and she mentioned that when Jose was taken, her whole family thought that he had just been brought to a remote prison in Patagonia. They really were not aware of the scale of what was happening. And it wasn't until much later that they understood that the people who had been taken were not coming back. And so once again, in the early 1980s, through especially international reporting and then some domestic reporting that was starting to happen in the media, Argentines began to realize the extent of what was happening. And that, of course, provoked great outrage and an erosion of support of the junta. And then lastly, and this is relevant for you as a Brit, there was the Falklands-Malvinas War, in which the Argentines lost in a very embarrassing manner. And this was a military government. And suddenly you had a stark example that the military couldn't even do the thing that it existed to do, which was to fight and win wars. And the confluence of those factors just really convinced the military itself that it was time to leave power.
And so once they did, the struggle, what the grandmothers were doing, it didn't end there. And one of the things I really liked about the book is how you follow the story up until the present day. If it was fiction, you'd have the happy ending and everyone would be rediscovered and reunited and it would all be great. But it wasn't quite like that. So how did people react to discovering their origins and being contacted and told how that they weren't who they thought they were? And what challenges did this create?
Yeah. So just to build on something you said, because I think it's very important to highlight, a lot of this book does cover history. It recounts historical events, but the grandmother's work and the mother's work to an extent is very much present work. You know, it has continued into today. So the grandmothers estimate that 500 babies and children were taken during the dictatorship, and they have found 140 of those 500. So many more grandchildren remain at large than have been found, although the grandmothers have been, you know, very successful and even pioneered new forms of genetic testing in order to find their stolen grandchildren. And they most recently found a grandchild just this past summer. So families continue to be reunited to the present day. To your other point, the grandmothers during the dictatorship, I think they imagined that finding their grandchildren was going to be the most formidable challenge that they faced. And very quickly, they realized that these very thorny dynamics arose even when they were able to identify their grandchildren. And that was that, you know, most of their grandchildren were raised by military and police families, as though those families were their biological families. and according to those ideologies also, because they grew up in those households. And the grandmothers found, especially after the dictatorship ended, when they started finding more grandchildren, that reclaiming those grandchildren from military and police families that didn't want to let them go was going to be really thorny. And that provoked a lot of custody battles when these grandchildren were still minors. But also that some of the grandchildren themselves, especially once they were in their teenage years and then once they were no longer minors, had really strong opinions and in certain cases really did not want to see their life that they had known for the, since they could remember, completely shattered and had no interest in reuniting with their biological families, at least at first. The interesting thing from researching this book that I noticed was that there were some cases of extreme resistance. And I tell one story in the book of a man named Ezekiel Tauro Rochestein. And Ezekiel was an adult when he was located. And he managed to resist genetic testing for 10 years. And he would pull all these tricks to do that. By the early 2000s, the grandmothers and the forensic experts were able to use toothbrushes and hairbrushes and other personal items in order to do genetic testing. You didn't need to convince someone to give their blood. And he would somehow figure out when a raid was going to happen and when someone was going to try to come take his personal items. And he would fill his gym bag with clothing from friends and other people that were not him in order to throw forensic experts off the track. And he, by a series of different stunts like this, he was able to evade genetic testing for 10 years. Ultimately, he was compelled to give his blood in court. And after he found out his true identity and was able to meet the grandmother who had looked for him his entire life, he really embraced her mission and the Abuelas organization. And I think that was very interesting for me to see. And it was quite reflective of the paths of a lot of other grandchildren, even those who initially really resisted their biological identities and the grandmother's movement.
And so, as you mentioned, Rosa, she was 105 and she passed away a couple of weeks ago. Most of the grandmothers are of that age, the ones that are still around. But as you've also said, there's still quite a lot of work to do. So, what do you think the future looks like for rediscovering these children?
Yeah. So Rosa had actually just turned 106, not even 105. She's
All right,
106.
sorry.
I feel it's such an incredible feat to live to that age. So there are a few grandmothers who are in their 80s and 90s who continue to actively participate in the Abuelas movement, and they are leading the movement. There's a saying within the movement that as long as there is a grandmother, the grandmother leads. This is a grandmother-led movement. But over the years, many of the grandchildren that the grandmothers have found have joined the ranks of the organization to support the mission to find their peers. And so even once the last grandmother passes away, their movement will continue through the grandchildren that they have found. And that those grandchildren are starting to kind of prepare to take on that mantle.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really nice to speak.
The book is called A Flower Traveled in My Blood: The Incredible True Story of the Grandmothers Who Fought to Find a Stolen Generation of Children. And it's out now.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.